This program features Amory Lovins on energy efficiency. The crisis in the Persian Gulf has once again clearly demonstrated the urgency for the United States to be energy efficient. There are few in this country who are more knowledgeable on this subject than Amory Lovins. A distinguished physicist, he was awarded the 1989 Onassis Foundation Delphi Prize for environmental work. He's the author of numerous books and articles on energy use and conservation. I interviewed Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Old Snowmass, Colorado. You've said that electricity is the most costly form of energy and that it takes up about a quarter of all global development capital. And you contend that most of that could be saved.
Yes, we have technologies on the market today that can provide exactly the same services as now or better, using only about a quarter as much electricity as now. And quadrupling our efficiency of using electricity in that way would cost much less than we pay right now to operate coal and nuclear plants, even if building them costs nothing.
How would you deliver those technologies to the individual consumer, for example?
That depends on the society. In some parts of the United States, especially for low-income customers, utilities simply give away the technologies. Southern California Edison Company, for example, has given away over 600,000 quadrupled efficiency light bulbs because it costs the utility less to do that than to operate its existing power stations to make the extra electricity which would otherwise be wasted in existing light bulbs. Utilities offer over half of Americans concessionary loans, that is at low or no interest, for fixing up their house to be more efficient, or rebates for buying more efficient appliances. Some utilities are leasing equipment so that you have only a small payment each month instead of a big one up front. Utilities provide many kinds of information on how to use electricity in a way that saves money. And there's a very exciting new set of market-oriented implementation methods we've developed, which effectively make saved electricity into a commodity, just like copper, wheat, and sow bellies. For example, we've already had the first deals signed in which one utility pays another utility to save electricity and sell it back to the first one at a favorable price. And you can do the same thing between customers, so anybody can profit by going bounty hunting for inefficient uses of electricity and fixing them up. In 8 states, there's competitive bidding, so if a utility wants more electricity, it simply says to the world at large, who out there would like to make or save or displace electricity? At what price? We will take the low bids, which of course turn out to be savings. We have about a dozen utilities selling efficiency for fun and profit in the territories of other utilities. Puget Power, for example, sells electricity in one state, but efficiency in 7 states. We've even figured out neat ways for gas utilities to make money selling electric efficiency. And Massachusetts is thinking of introducing a law this year in which if you hook up a new building to the grid and it's inefficient, you pay a fee, and the worse the building, the bigger the fee. But if you hook up an efficient new building, the utility pays you to hook it up, and the more efficient the building, the bigger the rebate.
You've taken a very dim view of the nuclear power industry's efforts to capture the electricity market, as it were. Why is that?
Well, this industry has absorbed altogether about $1 trillion of public and private capital. It's delivering less energy than wood, and it's so uneconomic that if you've just built a reactor, it's cheaper to write it off and give away that much efficiency instead than to run the plant. I can't think of any other case where so much has been spent by so many for so little. And even if there weren't much cheaper options on the supply side, which there certainly are today, the things you can do on the customer side of the meter would certainly knock nuclear out of consideration on straightforward economic grounds. We can now save 4 times as much electricity as the nuclear plants make at something like an eighth the cost of running them, even if building them were free. And it's not free, it's billions of dollars per plant. So I think that goes a long way toward explaining why this technology is dying of an incurable attack of market forces throughout the world's market economies, and why I feel that those who think it's such a great idea should put their own capital into it instead of continuing to try to put our money where their mouths are.
What are your views on solar energy?
Well, we're doing this interview in front of a building at 7,100 feet, where it goes to minus 47 degrees on occasion, our heating bill is essentially zero because we get over 99% of our space and water heating from the sun. And because we're so efficient, our household electric bill is about $5 a month. The extra cost of all that efficiency added 1% to the construction cost and paid back in the first 10 months. That kind of solar energy, passive solar space and water heating, is extremely cost effective if you do it right. And we're also just installing on the roof some solar cells, which ordinarily aren't cost effective unless you're at least a quarter mile from a power line, and then it's cheaper to get efficiency and photovoltaic cells for solar electricity than to run the wire to hook up to the grid. But in our case, they're worthwhile anyway because they give us much more reliable and higher quality power than we can get from the utility. And that saves us from having to buy some very fancy and costly power supplies for our computers.
Well, what might individuals living in Detroit or San Francisco or New York, in our large urban centers where they don't have access to this kind of land or these kinds of facilities, what might they do? Are you suggesting that common thing of, well, turn off the CD player, turn off your lights when you leave the house? Are those really alternatives?
We are specifically not talking here about doing without anything or being, as used to be said, hotter in the summer and colder in the winter. What we're talking about is doing the same jobs as well or better, using less electricity by using more brains, using better technologies. And anybody, no matter where they live, can wring a lot more work out of the electricity and other forms of energy they already have. For example, the next time you buy a refrigerator, by informing yourself what's on the market, you can get one two or three times as efficient as you have now, and it'll cost about the same and have the same features. It's just designed better with thicker insulation in the walls and so on. And if you don't have electric space or water heating, the refrigerator is probably the biggest single part of your household electric bill. It's probably upwards of $10 a month, so you can save half or two-thirds of that at essentially no extra cost. If you're going to buy a color television, you could get one with the same features, same price, using 40 or 50 watts instead of 150 watts. There are seven things you can do to your electric water heating system and the uses of water, like shower heads, that will give you as good service or better using a third as much electricity. And the list goes on and on like this. I think people are pretty smart and can solve a lot of their own problems if they have access to information about what the best buys are, where to get them, and how to shop for them.
Let's talk a little bit about automobiles, because that seems to be very intimate and well-known to most Americans. Fuel-efficient prototype cars have been developed and tested. For example, Volvo has tested a car that gets 71 miles per gallon. Peugeot has developed a car that gets 92 miles per gallon. Why aren't these cars on the American market?
Well, it's especially interesting to ask that because those two particular models are claimed to cost nothing extra to build. Why aren't they on the market? Well, very simple. The car companies, like the oil companies, foresee essentially flat real oil prices for at least 20 years to come. So there's really no incentive for them to take the risk of completely new tooling, new stocks of spare parts, retraining all their maintenance people and so on for new kinds of cars when they can continue to make a profit and hold market share with the models and tooling they've already paid for. Now, fortunately, Massachusetts and California, and I think increasingly some other states, probably Iowa, are taking a leadership position. They're starting to consider ways to affect people's car buying decisions up front. For example, by having a fee on new cars if they're inefficient. The more inefficient they are, the bigger the fee. And then using that money to pay rebates to people who buy efficient new cars. The more efficient, the bigger the rebate. In fact, you could tie the rebate to scrapping your old car to get it forever off the road if it's worse than a certain efficiency level, or you could base the rebate for efficient new cars on the difference in efficiency between the new car and the old automobile which you scrap. And that would turn over the car fleet a lot faster and get those old petro pigs off the road. Now, the basic reason for this is twofold. First, only a fifth of the cost of driving is fuel. So even if we had a hefty increase in the gasoline tax, it wouldn't have that much influence on what kind of car people buy, especially because when you buy a more efficient car, you tend to pay about as much more to buy it as you pay less to run it. So you end up indifferent to its efficiency over at least a threefold range, say 20 to 60 odd miles a gallon. But secondly, it is that at least threefold range of efficiency that the customer is economically indifferent to that is putting almost a car's weight per car per year of carbon into the air, driving global warming, that is creating a lot of urban smog and a lot of acid rain, and is making us pay about $50 billion a year of naval bills in the Persian Gulf. If we just improve the car fleet by 3 miles a gallon, we've got rid of our Mideast oil imports right there. So because these are real social costs, which we're all paying for in various ways, society has a strong interest in giving you a better trade-in offer on your old inefficient car than your dealer will give you. I'm very pleased that a number of leading states are starting to appreciate this. I think California may introduce such a scheme first to clean up the air in, say, the Los Angeles basin. Massachusetts may do it for balance of payments reasons. They have a proposal to take their 5% sales tax on new cars and swing it over a range of 0 to 10%, depending on how efficient the new car is. I think if a few states do that, it will get the 9 or 10 manufacturers who have prototyped cars in the 67 to 138 mile a gallon range to get them onto the U.S. market and start competing for those who will first buy such things. I know I would if one were available.
Do you think the development of a extensive rail network within the United States would be a positive development?
I think it would. It's often difficult to do because the rights of way have been bought up by others and used for other purposes. And the only way you can make rail public transit work economically is to make it simple, like most of the European systems, rather than things like BART or the Washington, D.C. Metro, which are grossly over-engineered and far too costly. But the Tijuana Trolley from San Diego is a good example of how you can run in the black in a private enterprise, self-sustaining way just by having clever, simple design. And when you look back at the pre-World War I maps, and you find that in those days you could go from Boston to St. Louis entirely on trolley cars, and the interurbans averaged 50 or 60 miles an hour, you realize we've lost something very important and need to think seriously about rebuilding it. I think we can also learn from innovations in countries like Brazil, where they're getting, in certain urban commuter bus lines, anywhere up to 40 times the density of passengers per corridor per hour that we get in our best systems. Very simple innovations like a boarding pod. It's a kind of a plastic tube closed at one end that sits on the curb. You go in through the open end and pay your fare as you enter, and every minute a bus pulls up, big doors open in both the side of the pod and the side of the bus. The floors are at the same level. The people go right onto the bus, the doors close, and the thing moves on. It's an incredibly cheap, efficient system, and their unsubsidized cost is only 10 cents a ride. I think we have a lot to learn from countries like Brazil that are having to solve these transit problems with no money, and they're getting real smart about it.
One of the goals of the Rocky Mountain Institute is seeking ideas which transcend ideology. Do you view ideology as an obstacle?
It can be an obstacle. We see this, for example, very much in the water wars. EPA, for example, is in the process of vetoing the proposed Two Forks Dam, a $1 billion water storage project near Denver, partly because folks like us had shown you could get more water than that at less than a fifth the cost by doing some simple water efficiency measures instead. And I don't mean having wimpy showers and brown lawns, quite the contrary. I mean getting the same services as now with a lot less water by using well-engineered shower heads, lawn watering equipment, toilets, and so on. And water providers around the country are doing this. But in the water business, as in the electric or oil business, you often find that people who cast themselves as champions of free enterprise are in reality corporate socialists. They want to be subsidized. They don't want to have to compete with efficiency. They just want to sell more of their product rather than providing the mixture of energy or water at efficiency that is the best buy for the customer. And it's quite alien to them to think that it's okay to sell, say, less electricity and bring in less revenue, when in fact that may lower their costs more than their revenues. They may make more money selling less of their product. Just as, you know, if you're in the shoe business, you know you can make money on margin instead of volume. So there's some basic psychological obstacles to overcome. And really the ideas we're talking about are very conservative. They're based on free markets, consumer sovereignty, local self-determination, individual choice, really good Jeffersonian values. And we're finding increasingly that political conservatives appreciate that we're talking their language, even though the result we come up with also appeals to political liberals. We may get there by a different method that we think works pretty well. Now, markets, of course, can't do everything. They're designed to be efficient, not sufficient. They never tell you how much is enough or when the national product is becoming too gross. And they're never meant to achieve values like justice or integrity or community. So if markets do something good for whales or wilderness or God or grandchildren, it's purely coincidental. That's why we have a political system, and I'm very critical of efforts to substitute $1, one vote for one person, one vote. That said, however, markets are awfully good at what they were meant to do, efficient allocation of resources over the short term. And I think creative use of market mechanisms can solve a lot of our resource problems and do a great deal to clean up the environment, not at an extra cost, but at a huge profit.
The United States has approximately 6% of the world's population, and it uses something like 40% of the total world's resources. How are you going to persuade Americans to make do with less, or is that not what you're advocating?
It's a very pejorative and I think misleading description of what we're advocating. We're suggesting using resources in a way that saves money to do the same jobs or to do them better. Our house has essentially no heating bill in a very cold climate, and it stays more comfortable with no furnace than our previous house did with three furnaces. That's fine. That means, in effect, we're living in a one-barrel-a-day oil well. We're getting $19 of energy savings every day, and that adds to our discretionary income. We can do good things with it. In fact, we can buy more kinds of efficiency with it or give it to people who are doing good work in the world. I don't think there's any difficulty persuading Americans, who are very pragmatic, bottom-line-oriented people, that if there's a better, cheaper way to do something, they ought to adopt it, because we're not talking about sacrifice at all. That's not even in the vocabulary, and that's why we talk about energy efficiency, not energy conservation, just to avoid that ambiguity. The interesting thing about this in the global development context you raise is that the average rich country today is about three times as energy efficient as is the average poor country. And yet, in the rich countries, like our own, we know how to increase, say, energy efficiency by at least a further fourfold, very cost-effectively, at present prices with present technologies. Well, that implies, in turn, when you put those two facts together, that if poor countries did it right the first time, if they became as efficient as we ought to be in the rich countries, then they ought to be able to expand their economies roughly tenfold without increasing their energy use at all. And meanwhile, in the rich countries, we could maintain or improve our standard of living while using several fold less energy than now over the coming decades, and we'd all meet in the middle.
Well, I think in that very issue of talking about the rich countries and the poor countries, you're raising some very serious cultural, political, and ideological issues. For example, I've talked to many people from the Third World who have a certain resentment toward the developed world telling them not to do this, not to develop this, not to essentially follow the so-called paradigm of the West.
We had a couple of guests from the Costa Rican government here yesterday. At the moment, we're working with a Ghanaian engineer who's trying to design energy efficiency programs for Ghana. They find our information of considerable value because it lets them choose, as they have every right and duty to choose, what kind of society they want. But it enables them to avoid our mistakes. I mean, why should they make the same old dumb mistakes we've made when they have the chance to make interesting new mistakes? And developing countries can't really afford to develop if they're inefficient, because they can't afford the luxury of mistakes that we made. China is a lovely example. They decided it was time everybody had refrigerators, so they built 100-odd refrigerator factories. The fraction of Beijing households owning a refrigerator went from 2% to 62% in 6 years. But unfortunately, through inattention, they chose a rather inefficient refrigerator design and thereby committed themselves to spend billions of dollars they don't have to build power plants to run those inefficient refrigerators. So in effect, they've hobbled their development and created power shortages in the name of trying to make their people better off. Now, if the people to whom this was pointed out are still around after the recent upheavals, I don't think they'll make that mistake again. They now realize that the only way they can hope to develop is to do it right the first time. And if that means adopting the best, not the worst, of our technologies, that imposes, as I think it does, a duty on us to export our most efficient, not our least efficient, technologies, and to set a good example. People in the third world are rightly very sensitive to hypocrisy, and I must say we find our message much easier to deliver from a super efficient building that's pleasant and saves a lot of money than if we were in an ordinary office with terribly inefficient lights, motors, and so on all over the place.
Well, and you're also not the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or the U.S. government.
No, but we're trying to work with those kinds of organizations to show that they could get at least 10 times as much benefit for the people they serve if they promoted efficiency as if they just continue to build power plants to run inefficient equipment.
In your writings, you seem to favor a more bottom-up approach, a grassroots approach, rather than the traditional top-bottom. Am I correct in that?
Very much, yeah. We're Jeffersonians, not Hamiltonians. We do not adopt the, I think, pernicious notion that most people are pretty dumb and need expert elites and bureaucracies to tell them how to live. And this is a thing that worries me about the global warming debate. You see, we really need technology transferred to the policymakers in Washington who don't realize that you can now very cost-effectively save 3/4 of the electricity and oil we use. And therefore, if you go to global warming conferences of several days with experts from all over the world, you'll find that the conference agenda typically leaves 5 minutes to talk about energy efficiency. Because after all, according to the organizers' view of the world, everybody knows that energy efficiency, although nice and essential, is going to be slow, small, difficult, and costly. So why talk about it? And yet, if they really caught up with modern developments in new equipment, new technology, new ways to finance and deliver it to the customers, they'd find it pretty much solves their problem. Now, because it is cheaper to save fuel than to buy and burn fuel, you can actually abate things like CO2 and acid rain and urban smog at a huge profit, a profit ultimately of about $1 trillion a year worldwide, which equals the entire world's military budget. That's a lot of money. In this country, the energy we waste still amounts to more than our entire military budget of $10,000 a second. And we're not getting any benefit for it. All we're doing is turning fuel into pollution. Now, I think that implies two important things. First of all, we shouldn't be trying to come up with an international treaty, as we did for chlorofluorocarbons, in which nations agree to share a sacrifice and to do something expensive and inconvenient for the common good. Instead, because saving energy is going to save lots of money, we should be helping nations, firms, and individuals behave in their economic self-interest. Secondly, it implies that the implementation ought to be largely through creative use of market forces rather than through establishing new bureaucracies and mandatory regulations.
Steven Schneider of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, has written much about the global warming effect and has talked about it as well. He has suggested that there must be a political will in the United States to address these problems, some of which you've touched upon in this interview. Do you see that political will, that consensus developing?
Yes, and I think, in fact, the people are way ahead of the politicians. You know, the old bumper sticker that said, if the people lead, eventually the leaders will follow. We have some leaders. We have, for example, the legislation proposed by Claudine Schneider, Republican Congresswoman of Rhode Island, and Tim Wirth, Democratic Senator from Colorado. And those have a lot of excellent ideas. But I think at a local and individual level, we're seeing even more leadership emerge. And it's, again, largely because even though people are rightly worried about global warming and other environmental problems, what everybody will agree on is saving money. And the things we need to do to, for example, abate global warming are things we ought to be doing regardless, even if we weren't worried about that at all, because we're going to make money on the deal. To abate global warming, we need to do three main things. One is energy efficiency. That has a strongly negative cost because efficiency is cheaper than fuel. Another is adopting sustainable farming and forestry practices. That's roughly a break even, as the National Academy of Sciences just concluded. Sustainable farming practices with low inputs, basically what you might call organic farming, is about as profitable as chemical unsustainable farming, often more so. And there are a lot of other reasons to do it, including not having poisons in our food and water. And thirdly, we need to displace the CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons, but we need to do that anyway to protect the ozone layer, so the cost is irrelevant. Now, if the cost of abating global warming then ranges from strongly negative to roughly zero to irrelevant, why fiddle while coal burns? It doesn't matter how the scientific uncertainties come out. We ought to be getting on with the job regardless.
That was Amory Lovins on energy efficiency. Amory Lovins is co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute in Old Snowmass, Colorado.